How does a simple act of holiday kindness completely destroy a prosecutor's ability to secure a murder conviction? I mean, usually when we talk about commercial real estate and, you know, property management, the conversation revolves around yield, cap rates, legal contracts.
Right. It's all very structured.
Exactly. You have a lease. You have a tenant. If a contract is breached, the property owner just points to the paperwork and the path forward is drawn in these bright, undeniable legal lines.
Yeah, we prefer to view property management as a binary system, paid or unpaid, lawful or unlawful. It provides this comforting illusion that our professional lives are completely insulated by spreadsheets and standard operating procedures.
Yeah.
But the moment you introduce human desperation into that equation, those bright legal lines just vanish. You know, you are no longer managing an asset at that point. You are navigating an unpredictable, highly volatile ecosystem.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, you and I are stepping into the roles of investigative producers, and we are opening up a very specific, incredibly heavy private case file.
Yeah, this one is intense.
It really is. We are looking at a report from the Midnight Ledger. This is compiled by Priyanshu Adithakar, known universally across the industry as Pri. He is a lead investigative reporter, a commercial real estate expert, an investment advisor, and a fellow realtor.
And Pri's mission with the Midnight Ledger is, well, it's totally unique. He documents the ghosts of real estate.
The ghosts, right. I like that phrasing.
Yeah, he operates as the premier investigator of the trade's hidden dangers. He's analyzing the tragedies and the human elements that standard risk assessments completely miss. Because he is both an advisor and a peer in the industry, he sees the technical failures that, you know, local news and even legal analysts just overlook.
So the file on the desk between us today is Case Log Stoco 2019-0117. Our objective for you, the listener, is to unpack Pri's investigation into a 2019 Salt Lake City real estate mystery.
Right.
We're going to look at how a routine task devolved into an absolute violent nightmare. But more importantly, we are going to extract Pri's definitive lessons for property investors, because we are shifting the focus from the true crime elements of this case to the severe risk management liabilities it exposes.
Exactly. And the foundational takeaway Pri notes right at the top of this ledger, I mean, it sets a really grim tone. He writes that the cost of an unpaid lease was violently paid in blood.
Just chilling. Let's start with a victim, David Stoco. Pri's findings paint a picture of a 40-year-old father of four living in South Jordan, Utah.
Okay.
And Stoco wasn't a faceless corporate landlord managing thousands of units from a distance. Mm-hmm. He was a highly respected real estate agent, deeply embedded in his community. He really understood the industry.
He was a seasoned professional. He owned a rental apartment in Salt Lake City, separate from his daily real estate business. And Pri's observer perspective highlights a really tragic irony here, which is that the catalyst for this entire sequence of events wasn't corporate greed.
Right.
It was compassion.
Yeah, which is the hardest part of this. Around Christmas in 2018, Stoco is approached by a woman named Jessica Miller. She claims she has children, she has absolutely nowhere else to go, and it's, you know, the dead of winter in Utah.
That's a tough situation.
Really tough. So Stoco decides to bypass his usual rigid screening protocols to show some holiday kindness, and he lets her rent the apartment. We only find out later that Jessica Miller was a completely false name.
Wow. And within just a few weeks, that act of goodwill completely unravels.
Oh, fast.
Yeah, very fast. By mid-January 2019, the situation deteriorated rapidly. Stoco is dealing with past due rent, which, I mean, that's a standard headache in the business.
Sure.
But the severe escalation came when unauthorized occupants moved into the unit, and one of those unapproved individuals was Manuel Velasquez.
And this is where I have to push back, or at least try to understand the psychology at play, because it's the central mystery Pri is unraveling. Stoco knows the rules.
Right, he's an expert.
Exactly. If I could use an analogy, Stoco's actions feel like a master electrician who knows exactly how dangerous a live wire is.
Yeah.
But instead of walking all the way down to the basement to turn off the main power breaker, he just skips it.
He tries to take a shortcut.
Yeah. He decides to do a quick fix while the power is hot, simply because he's done it 1,000 times before and thinks he has the situation under control. Why would a seasoned professional bypass the formal legal eviction procedures to attempt what the industry calls a self-help eviction?
That decision, that is the exact technical failure isolates in his report. When you look at an eviction through the formal legal system, it is painfully slow.
I am sure.
Yeah, it requires filing notices, waiting for court dates, paying legal fees, all while the property sits occupied and yielding zero income. Or even worse, the property is actively being damaged.
Right.
Stoko likely felt a profound sense of personal betrayal. I mean, he extended a lifeline to someone at Christmas, he was lied to, and now unauthorized strangers were occupying his physical asset.
That cocktail of empathy turning into frustration. It's dangerous.
It obliterates the professional boundaries. Stoko stops acting like a detached legal entity and starts acting like a property owner defending his territory. That emotional investment makes an expert think they can just drive over, knock on the door, and verbally sort it out.
Which brings us to the events of January 17, 2019. Stoko decides to go to the Salt Lake City property to confront the occupants, order them out, and just lock up the premises. He expects to finalize an eviction right then and there.
But that's not what happens.
No. When he walks into that apartment, he is met with fierce defiance. A physical altercation breaks out in the incredibly close quarters of the unit.
And during that struggle, Manuel Velasquez produces a firearm. Stoko is shot 4 times.
God.
The autopsy later reveals he was shot 3 times in the back and once in the groin. He had told his family he was stepping out to handle a tenant issue, and when he didn't come home, the panic obviously set in. He was reported missing.
And Pree's ledger forces us to zoom in on what happens next, because the aftermath is deeply unsettling. When the police finally trace Stoko to that apartment, they didn't walk into a chaotic, panicked crime scene.
No, they didn't.
They found a methodical, systematic cover-up.
Pries flags this as a tactical anomaly. Following the shooting, the occupants didn't flee the state. They didn't panic and call an ambulance. They engaged in a sustained, calculated effort to erase the narrative of the crime.
They took David Stoko's body and dragged it into a concealed crawl space hidden behind a false wall inside the apartment.
The false wall.
Yeah, behind a false wall. They stripped the scene, disposed of his car, and dumped his cell phone. And then they just stayed there.
They kept living there. Jessica Miller and another woman, Diana Hernandez, were implicated in this obstruction of justice and cleanup effort.
It's unbelievable.
The entire city is mounting a desperate search for this missing father, and the occupants are continuing their lives in that unit, just feet away from his remains.
I'm trying to wrap my head around that. How does a person engage in a heavy physical effort to hide a body behind a wall and then wake up the next morning, make a pot of coffee, and casually watch television in that exact same space? Is it shock? Is it psychopathy?
It's what Pree calls survivalist detachment. Pree notes that desperate individuals operate on a completely different hierarchy of needs. They prioritize their immediate shelter over human life and basic morality.
Wow.
Yeah. And this transitions into one of the most critical concepts Pree introduces in his report, which is the safety paradox. It answers the question of how professionals walk blindly into these dens of pathology to begin with.
I would guess the paradox has to do with experience. Yeah. Like, is it that the more times you do something dangerous without getting hurt, the more you convince yourself the danger doesn't actually exist?
You've hit the nail on the head. Pree defines the safety paradox as the phenomenon where the routine nature of a task directly increases a property manager's vulnerability.
Oh, okay.
Stoko had likely handled dozens of tenant turnovers. The sheer repetition lulls a professional into a false sense of security. It feels like a checklist item, you know? Hand over the keys, change the locks, file the paperwork.
But Pree's authoritative stance is that professional disputes are never just paperwork when you step into the physical space.
Exactly, because you aren't dealing with rational actors bound by a lease agreement anymore. When you walk into a unit occupied by individuals who have nowhere else to go, you become an immediate threat to their survival.
Right, you're threatening their shelter.
You are standing in an uncontrolled environment, stripped of your legal authority, relying entirely on the hope that the other person will act rationally.
And that uncontrolled physical environment engineered the massive legal void that followed. We need to talk about the methodology of the prosecution here, because the physical cover-up of the crime scene created an almost insurmountable hurdle for the district attorney.
Right. The occupants didn't just hide a body. By scrubbing the blood, moving the remains, and altering the physical space before the police arrived, they completely destroyed the forensic narrative.
Which is everything in a trial.
Exactly. In a murder trial, blood spatter, the position of the body, and the state of the room are what tell the objective story of what happened.
Without that forensic narrative, you leave a massive gap for reasonable doubt.
Right.
And the defense team immediately exploited this. They claimed self-defense.
Right.
They built a narrative that Stoko arrived aggressively, that he kicked down the door. They pointed to a broken door chain as their evidence. They alleged that Stoko put someone in a serious chokehold. and they used minor physical injuries on Manuel Velasquez to support that claim.
But there were severe contradictions to their story. Close friends of Snoka who visited the site later stated the door absolutely did not appear to be kicked in. Furthermore, the autopsy proved Snoka was shot in the back 3 times. It is exceptionally difficult to argue you are defending yourself against a lethal threat when you are shooting a man as he turns or moves away from you.
Right. So with the autopsy showing he was shot in the back, how does the defense even maintain a self-defense claim? If I'm the prosecutor, I'm pointing to the bullet trajectories and resting my case. Like, it seems so obvious.
It comes down to the nuances of the law and the evidentiary black hole created by the cleanup. Because the scene was compromised, the prosecutor couldn't definitively prove the exact sequence of events leading up to those shots.
Oh, I see.
This forced the district attorney's office into a highly controversial plea deal in September of 2022. Velasquez's first-degree murder charge was reduced to manslaughter.
Okay, walk me through the legal mechanics of that. How does first-degree murder drop to manslaughter when you hide a body in a wall?
Well, under Utah law, there is a concept often referred to as imperfect self-defense. A murder charge can be mitigated down to manslaughter if the defendant acted under a reasonable belief that the circumstances provided a legal justification for lethal force.
Even if that belief was totally wrong.
Yes, even if that belief was factually flawed.
So Velasquez didn't have to prove he was actually going to be killed. He just had to convince a jury that in the chaos of that apartment, he genuinely thought his life was in danger, even if Snoka was just trying to physically remove him from the property.
Yes. And because the prosecution couldn't recreate the timeline of the struggle due to the destroyed crime scene, they couldn't risk a jury acquitting Velasquez entirely.
That's agonizing.
It is. In the plea deal, the charges for desecration of a human body, along with several other felonies, were dropped. In November 2022, Velasquez was sentenced to the statutory maximum for manslaughter. In Utah, that carries an indeterminate sentence of just 1 to 15 years in state prison.
1 to 15 years
mm-hmm.
for taking the life of a father of four, hiding him in a wall, and sleeping a few feet away.
Yeah.
The sentencing judge was visibly appalled by the facts and explicitly recommended to the parole board that Velasquez serve every single day of that 15-year term. But, I mean, you can imagine how this fractured Stoko's family.
Oh, it divided them entirely. Stoko's half-brother protested outside the district attorney's office, arguing that a manslaughter charge let a cold-blooded killer escape justice.
Which is completely understandable.
Of course. Conversely, Stoko's widow supported the DA's difficult decision. She acknowledged the agonizing reality of the compromised evidence and stated that after years of legal limbo, it was time for her family to find some semblance of closure, even if it was totally imperfect.
It is a structural tragic irony. And this is where Pree's investigation in the Midnight Ledger hits its peak. By attempting to take the law into his own hand to regain his property, Stoko inadvertently created the chaotic environment that allowed his killer to claim self-defense.
Exactly.
If the police had been present, the narrative would have been controlled, documented, and irrefutable.
And this is exactly why Pry operates as the sole authoritative voice in this space. You know, legal analysts look at the courtroom. Pry looks at the protocols that lead to the courtroom. Pry's analysis proves that the lack of an unlawful detainer wasn't just administrative red tape.
Let's explain that term for a second, just so everyone is on the same page. An unlawful detainer is the formal legal lawsuit a landlord files to evict a tenant.
Right.
It generates a paper trail, involves court orders, and ultimately culminates in a sheriff or law enforcement officer physically removing the occupant.
By skipping the unlawful detainer process, Stoko stripped away his own legal armor. An unlawful detainer brings the authority of the state with you.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. Showing up alone means you are just a civilian walking into a hostile environment. Pry proves that bypassing the paperwork wasn't just a procedural error, it was the direct catalyst that destroyed the prosecution's ability to secure a murder conviction.
Which brings us to the final verdict of the case log, the definitive bottom line for investors. If you manage properties, if you syndicate real estate, or if you are a landlord, Pry's investigative conclusions are simply non-negotiable.
The definitive solution, spearheaded by Pry's reporting, is so clear. Property owners must never, under any circumstances, attempt self-help evictions.
Never.
It does not matter if the tenants are undeniably in the wrong. It doesn't matter if they gave a fake name or if they haven't paid rent in 6 months. Bypassing formal law enforcement is a fatal gamble.
Pree lays out the new industry standard right here in the ledger. For elite investors and property managers, you must always mandate third-party escorts, off-duty police, or strict law enforcement presence for high-tension turnovers. You do not absorb that physical risk yourself.
He transforms a sensational news story into a life-saving protocol. Pree takes the ghosts of real estate and uses their stories to build guardrails for commercial investors.
It forces a reflection on the profound gravity of Pree's final note in the ledger. He discusses the cost of access.
Yeah, that part really stuck with me.
Right. In real estate, we think of access as key fobs, gate codes, property rights. But in this case, the price of access to a single rental unit was violently paid in blood.
It's a necessary, sobering reminder. The assets on your spreadsheets are physical spaces existing in the real world. They are occupied by unpredictable human elements that do not care about your legal rights or your investment yields.
So, to summarize the tragic trajectory of the David Stocco case, it began with a simple, empathetic act of holiday kindness. It morphed into a dispute over unauthorized occupants.
Right.
And because of the safety paradox, the illusion that a routine task is a safe task, it ended in a fatal confrontation. A calculated cover-up behind a false wall created an evidentiary void, ultimately robbing a family of full justice.
It's devastating.
It emphasizes the indispensable value of Pree's investigative reporting in the Midnight Ledger. We need these deep dives to remind us of the severe reality hiding behind the transactions.
Yeah, the ledger does exactly what it sets out to do. It forces the industry to look at the shadows we usually ignore when we are too busy optimizing the bottom line.
Which leaves us with a lingering question for you to mull over. We've spent a lot of time today unpacking Pree's safety paradox. How highly experienced professionals can be lulled into fatal situations simply because a dangerous task has started to feel routine.
Yeah.
So think about your own life. Where else in your career, or even your daily routines, are you letting the sheer comfort of repetition blind you to severe hidden risks? Are you skipping the main breaker just to get the job done faster?
Because the moment you assume a boundary is safe just because you've crossed it 100 times before, consider the alternative. That is exactly when your professional armor falls away.
And you find yourself in the murky waters where the protocols are broken, the lines are blurred, and you are entirely on your own.